One of the great privileges of working at the hospital is being with folks at very sort of crucial and important and beautiful moments of their life. And there's one, a few examples of that this week, in fact, but one particularly was going to visit Neil and Liz Everett just a few hours after the baby Isabel had been born. It's great because you miss all the gory stuff and all the pain and stuff like that and just get there for that vision of beauty lying in a cot. It's the baby, by the way, not that Liz isn't. Well, I'll stop there, right? But just this lovely product of a chance meeting of one lucky sperm out of thousands and a monthly produced egg. This beautiful bunch of organs and flesh and bones with wrapped up in skin. Marvellous. Marvellous. Marvellous accident of nature. Or a unique baby human being. Conceived in an act of love and formed and fashioned by God's loving hand. Which one? Which one do you reckon? The latter, I think. And it's hard to see it any other way, isn't it? It's hard to see a child like that as just a bunch of skin and bones. And I don't know about you, but I go gooey when I see babies like that. And you gaze at this baby and any other newborn baby, and as well as words like lovely and beautiful, some other words come to mind as well. Words like helpless and vulnerable and dependent. Totally dependent. And the fact is, Isabel has been dependent for the past 9 months already, hasn't she? On Liz for nourishment, on a safe place to grow. Just because the cord's being cut now doesn't mean that this child becomes independent. She's as dependent as she was, or has been, for food and for drink, for protection, for love, for an environment in which to grow. And as she grows, she's dependent on others for guidance and training and love. Isabel needs responsible adults to help her become a responsible adult. And that's a job that falls most of the time to parents, although it's not always the case that the natural parents will bring up the child. And even when it is those parents, there are others like teachers and grandparents and friends who play a part in bringing up that child, in parenting that child, if you like. But it's usually the parents, and that's the relationship we look at tonight. And ever since Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 to 28, where God said, well, the Bible says, so God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them, and God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Ever since that moment that God made human beings in his own image, male and female with compatible reproductive organs, ever since Adam and Eve's eldest squeezed his way into the world kicking and screaming, ever since then, there's been a need for parents. Where we're going to go tonight is I'm going to just do a few words, just as quickly as I can, generally about this relationship. Really going to look at the child to begin with. Then we're going to ask two questions. How to love your child? And Sharon's going to come and share some thoughts on that. And then how to discipline your child? And I'm going to share some thoughts on that. And we should be finished by midnight, I think, if we're lucky. If there's time at the end, we'll time some prayer as well to pray for our parents that we know, for ourselves perhaps, for our children. And just to say, and I'll say it before Sharon does, because I know she feels this very strongly, that neither of us are experts in this. I've been a parent for 24 years now. I'm still learning I've been a child for 48 years, and I'm still, I don't mean a child in that sense. You know, I've got parents, and I'm childish, and I'm still learning. And I realise that the only difference tonight between me and you is that I've had a chance to read some books this week. Well, from the moment you first gaze at a new baby, you'll be overwhelmed by a sense of privilege that this child is yours, and probably at the same time daunted by a sense of responsibility that it's your job to bring this child up in the right way. And really need to keep both of those things in tension. And so this sense of privilege, just want to say quickly, just four things that it's good to remember about our children, those of us who are parents. First thing to say is that each child is uniquely created. Some words from Psalm 139, verse 13 to 16, where David's thanking God for the way he was created. "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." It's even allowing for that one in a thousand chance of a sperm and an egg getting it together, as it were. Each child is unique. Each child is handmade, and it's God's hand that's made this child. It's He who fashions and forms the child and brings together the DNA from each parent and the characteristics and traits from each parent that He wants to bring. One of the books I've read this week, I think I've got it here, yeah, I'll refer to it later. There's a teacher inside says, "The amazing thing was," his teacher said, "I've never met the same child twice." And it's true, isn't it? Every child is different. Every child, each child, every child has value and worth because they're uniquely created by God. Just let that sink in. Every child has value and worth because they're uniquely created by God. Even the ones that you can't stand on a Sunday morning because they're running around church. Even those who kick footballs through your windows and into your garden. You know, all of those kids who don't do as they're told, even those kids have value and worth because they're uniquely created by God. And if we take this in, then it spares us from comparison with others. Now, comparison, as a parent, I know that comparison sort of sneaks up on you, really. You meet up with other parents and you talk about your children. In fact, that's all you'll talk about for a few months and a few years, probably. And you compare because your child's been sleeping through the night after 1 week. And poor old so-and-so, they're still going after 6 years. And your child has produced this fine set of perfect teeth after 3 weeks. And somebody else is really struggling and crying in the night. And of course, your baby's crawling and walking and reading after 4 weeks, and of course you admit, don't you, the fact that your child is biting and kicking and fighting with everybody, and so on and so forth. And you know, it never stops, does it? Christmas letters, you probably received them, but you know, Johnny's now at level 17 in the oboe, and you know, it goes on, doesn't it, like that? And actually, how healthy is that? When we realise that every child is made in the wonderful image of God. And it's a unique creation. And it means that we don't need to compare and likewise don't need to judge. Each child is unique. Second thing is that children are sinners. And I quote scripture for this, although actually you only need to be with kids once they've learned to crawl, don't you, for a few minutes to realise that it's true. Anyway, Psalm 51 verse 5. Again, David talking to God. "Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me." It's hard to believe when your kids are asleep that they're sinners. My favourite photograph of my eldest lad is is lying in his cot like that. Well, with one arm like that, and the other one like that. Just dribbled down there. And just, oh, bless that child. And yet, even he had an inbuilt bias towards deceit and rebellion at an early age. Fact is, you don't have to teach children to lie. It comes natural. There's a few nods out there. So obviously, some of you are children too young yet to speak. But believe me, once they can speak, they learn to lie. As soon as they realise that their parents can't see round corners, they exploit that fact. Now, if you accept that your child is a sinner, then you won't be shocked when your child first sins. It's quite normal. So let battle commence. Children are sinners. Third thing is that children are arrows into the future. That's a quote from Psalm 127, where Solomon writes, sons are a heritage from the Lord, children a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are sons born in one's youth. And I think what he's trying to say is that, or at least what comes out of it for me, is that this arrow, this child, this arrow, is, which is shot, you know, into the future, as it were, needs to be aimed, needs to be guided to find the right place in life. It's funny, isn't it? Because each week by week, you know, the genetics and the whole DNA thing, and every week you read that they've now found the gene which determines that you're going to be lazy, or found the gene which determines that you're going to be a thief or something when you grow up. You know, it all seems to be genetic now. And you might start to believe that the script is already written, that there's nothing you can do to alter the way you are or to change the way things go on, that you have no control over these things. But that's not what the Bible says. It's quite clear that parents have a major role in shaping the character and the values of their children around that unique personality that they have. And perhaps the most famous verse to help us think that through is Proverbs 22 and verse 6, where it says, train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. Train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. Your mission, parents, and you have no choice but to accept it, is to train your child in the way he should go. And we come on a little bit to that later when we look at discipline. Our job as responsible adults is to nurture tomorrow's responsible adults. We're about nurturing tomorrow's leaders and tomorrow's bin men and tomorrow's parents, in fact. And so the job we make of that is important for generations to come. It's in this sense that children are arrows to the future. If we don't direct them, if we don't aim them, who will? And finally, a child has a special place in God's heart. And for that, Matthew chapter 19 and verse 14, where children were brought to Jesus for him to place his hands on them and pray for them. The disciples were saying, oh, stay away, stay away, stay away. But Jesus said, let the little children come to me and do not hinder them. For the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. And he placed his hands on them and blessed them. Every child has a special place in God's heart. Liz and Neil will be bonding with Isabel as we speak. That first gaze, that first suck, that grip on your finger from those tiny hands, first smile when it comes. It's a special relationship, isn't it, between parents and children. And in 15 years or so, first boyfriend, first disco, if they still have discos in those days, dad gonna stay out late, I'll be all right, don't worry about me. And at some point along the line, there'll be some pain and there'll be some hurt. And it'll hurt because it's still a special relationship, and the love you feel on that first day is the love that you feel 20 years down the line. And it's when it hurts, I guess, that it's good to remember that that child is even more precious to God. The child is God's child too, on loan to the parents in whom he's entrusted the nurture of his child. Each child is a gift from God, uniquely made and loved by him, to be loved by us, with the potential for sin, and so needing some guidance. So we've got this sort of relationship off the ground. And how do we love our children? And Sharon, finally, is going to come and share with us.
I've been reading books as well, some for the second time and some for the first. So I'm going to read a bit from A Guide to Being a Mum to start with. It's 4:30 p.m. and I'm in the kitchen trying to work out what to give the children for tea while answering strange questions about Henry VIII and his numerous wives, looking for lines of symmetry and a piece of maths homework, organising who watches what on TV and explaining why my decision is fair and it's only Monday. I'm pretty certain that this is the sort of scene that's repeated in thousands of homes across the country at the same time every day. When I had my first child, I had no idea that a relatively quiet life would turn out like this. If every mother was endowed with the gift of hindsight on the arrival of their firstborn, being with mum would be so much easier. Alternatively, it would mean that the first babies remained only children. Instead, the baby arrives with fist clenched, her helpless gaze, and in that moment, whether you're prepared or not, you've got the role of a responsible adult. Before you even start to grapple with that idea, you're swamped with nappies, toothy grins, first day at school, and suddenly you're standing in the kitchen contemplating burgers and chips and why Henry has so many wives called Catherine. And it all happens so quickly that you barely have time to sit down and think about what you're doing. Then someone suddenly calls out the well-known name, Mum. Some days I think, if I hear that word one more time, I'm going to scream. I've got three children. I think everybody, I think Phil knows, maybe not. Three children, 11, 8 and 6, all very different, different demands, different personalities. When Ian asked me to do this, I thought, help, where'd you start? And there's quite a few people here that have got far more experience than me as well. So I haven't reached the teenagers yet. One thing, book that I've read for the second time, and it is a really helpful book, is How to Really Love Your Child. And love is something that every child needs and needs a lot of. So at the end, we're going to look at what is love. In 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4, love is patient, love is kind, it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it is not rude. It is not self-seeking, it's not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres. Love never fails. Over have somewhere. So love is patient. I think I struggle with that as a parent an awful lot. It's kind, not easily angered, forgiving, protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres. I think we've got a foundation of that love in our relationships as parents and with our families, that this will affect our children throughout their lives. The children shown love, loved and seeing love through others, learn to love and be loved, and they reflect the love that they're shown. love is unconditional. I think the patience and kindness and perseverance come about in unconditional love. Loving no matter what. Children drive us mad sometimes, and I think there's a lot of things children do that we just can't stand. And it's like the prodigal son, he was accepted back by his father, no matter what he'd done. I think to love unconditionally, the children need to know that what they do is the thing we don't like, not them, and we need to tell them that we love them, no matter what they've done. I'm sure situations in a family like with the prodigal son, the elder son would have loved to tell folks what his younger brother had been up to, and I guess in family situations we get a lot of telltaling like that, and we need to make sure that both parties are loved in the same way. Love keeps no record of wrongs. We need to start each day afresh and tell the children that it's a new start. My nephew, when he was younger, had had a bad day and his mum had told him off, and he eventually said sorry to her, and the next day he'd done the same thing again, so she went and told him off again and quoted what he'd done the day before, and he said, but mum, I thought when you said you'd forgiven that you'd forgotten as well. So I think children need to know that we've drawn a line under things that they've done previously. Having unconditional love, though, doesn't mean that we don't discipline our children. Ian's going to talk on that later. Love and discipline go together. It's like the example of a child with a fire. We love them, we wouldn't want them to hurt themselves on the fire, so we train them not to touch the fire. So the future of our children depends on the foundation of love around them and of unconditional love to them as well. A couple of questions really that go along with each of these bits is, how often do we say to our children that we love them, and how often do we tell them how special they are to us? It's very easy to go for weeks and weeks and not actually verbalise how much our children mean to us. Showing love to our children, there's three different ways of showing love. One is with eye contact, and I think for Liz and Neil at the moment, it'll be very much they'll look at their baby and they'll smile and they'll try and get that eye contact. And it's easy to do that with the little ones and get a response back when they're old enough to smile at us. Eye contact shows emotions, acceptance, but also disapproval, and it's very easy to use eye contact just in a disciplinary way or a disapproving way with our children, and we need to work at using eye contact to encourage our children and show that they're loved. Eye contact can show that we're really listening to them and that we're focused on them. The lack of eye contact, a typical example is when you're busy getting dinner ready, and Cara has a wonderful knack of knowing when I'm not really listening to her, and she'll nag until I stop and listen. She normally works that one out. But the lack of eye contact, the lack of focused attention can be quite negative for the children. The focused attention, a full undivided attention, makes them feel valued and important. One thing I think I need to do is let the answer phone go and tell the boys, especially at bedtime, not to answer the phone when I'm putting one of the others to bed, and give them that time slot where they have individual attention at the end of the day. Another idea is to have days out on a one-to-one. It doesn't need to be a day out. Ian's got into a pattern of taking them off, doing different things with them each on a different day, and they love that. They think that's really special. But it could be just a half-hour walk, a little bit of time individually with one parent. Makes them feel great. And individual attention, no matter what age, I think whether we've got little ones or older ones, it can really build up a child. And in this book it talks about filling their tanks. I'll find my piece of paper. Each child has an emotional tank. This tank is figurative, of course, but in a sense it's very real. Each child has certain emotional needs, and whether these emotional needs are met through love, understanding or discipline, this determines, first of all, it determines how a child feels, whether he's content, angry, depressed or joyful. Secondly, it affects his behaviour, whether he's obedient or disobedient, whiny, perky, playful or withdrawn. Naturally, the fuller the emotional tank, the more positive the feelings and the better behaviour. I guess you have to be a little bit careful with that as children if they're tired, no matter how much time that you give them. It's not really going to do a lot of good. I think I can remember with one of mine getting so frustrated and in the end just saying you're going to have to go to bed. And I went back 5 minutes later and they were fast asleep. So you sort of have to be a bit careful and not think, gosh, I'm not doing enough for my child. Physical contact, the need changes as they grow. I guess those of you with older children will know that you get shrugged off if you try and give them a hug or whatever. The younger the child, the lots of hugs and kisses and also contact like rough and tumble. Mine, very ticklish. They love to have to be tickled and have fun that way. And it can be fun too. And it's also a very important part of their contact and feeling loved. As they grow up, they like less physical contact, although with mine, the eldest one still quite likes to have a hug, and he'll always kiss me goodbye before he goes to school, where Alex doesn't like it so much, and he'll give me a kiss if there's nobody watching down the road. I was putting Alex to bed last week, and I said, "Good night, Alex, I love you." And he said, "Oh, Mom," I said, "you've told me that millions of times." So I said, "Well, do you want me to stop telling you then?" He said, "No." He said, but don't tell me in the middle of town." I don't know when I've ever thrown my arms around him and told him I loved him in the middle of town, but there you go. So it changes, and you have to respect that change as well. He would get very embarrassed if I went and gave him a big kiss outside the school gate, whereas Sam wouldn't mind. So you have to be careful. So how often do we show undivided attention to our children? Something I'd like to talk about is encouraging children and role models as well. Sam's has always been quite a nervous child, and found things really difficult, changes, things like that really difficult. And it's finding out what they enjoy, things that are going to build up their confidence. And for him, it's sport. He loves his sport, and swimming, basketball, anything like that. And to compete in things like that has really brought out Sam in himself and his confidence. Being positive with them as well in the things that they do, just to encourage them. Some days I think, have I said anything positive to them at all? And it's easy to feel like that. The day Ian phoned me to ask if I'd do this, I had had the worst morning I think I'd had in a few years as a kid. I'd been a real nagging mum and very negative. I'd ended up sending one to their room before school. It was not a good start to the day. And really, generally, I had a really, really negative morning. And I got home and I felt absolutely dreadful. And I knew that they probably felt dreadful as well at school. So Ian phoned, and I think I laughed at you when you asked me to answer the phone. And Ian said, "What's the matter?" So I told him. And Ian said, "Oh, that's all right." He said, "We didn't want the perfect mum anyway." So I felt a lot better after that. But it's hard. It's hard when you've had a morning like that and you think, well, what positive was there to bring out of a situation like that? But it doesn't make anybody feel any better. The role model situation with church, I actually been quite encouraged by. I have somebody sitting right in front of me here who's been fantastic with Sam and taken him out fishing, spent that time. Lawrence Neat, not here tonight, but he'll talk to Sam just for a few minutes on a Sunday morning about his guitar. And it's just great to have, especially for the older boys, I think, as they get older, that sort of thing for the children, know that they've got adults at church that they can relate to and talk to in a comfortable way. Sam really struggles at school with not having Christian friends at school, and it was a real encouragement today to have this new lad, Jack, here, who's the same age as Sam, and hoping to go to the same high school as him as well. So it's good to build up those relationships at church. There's an awful lot of people that do for kids and Sunday schools, and just talking to them after the services and things, and that really does encourage them. I think it's those people outside the family that the children are more likely to go to when they've got difficulties later on. If they feel comfortable to go to them, they're not likely to come to mum and dad. And as parents, it's really great to know that they've got those people to go to. I think Ian's going to talk on discipline for a few minutes.
Actually, I was trawling the internet this week and I found a poem, strangely enough, called Sharon is the Perfect Mother. I don't think it's you, Sharon, but it highlights, I think, it highlights an issue. Let's just have a listen to it. Everyone said Sharon was a terrific mother. Her neighbours said it. She painted the inside of her garbage cans with enamel. She grew her own vegetables. She cut her own grass every week. She made winter coats for the entire family from remnants. She donated blood, and she made Barbara a doll cake for her birthday. Everyone said Sharon was a terrific mother. Her mother said it. Sharon colour coordinated the children's clothes and put them in labelled drawers. She laundered aluminium foil and used it again. She cut everyone's hair, and she knew her national insurance number off by heart. Everyone said Sharon was a terrific mother. Her children's teacher said it. She helped her children every night with her homework. She did her son's paper round when it rained. She packed nutritious lunches with little raised faces on the sandwiches. Must be American, this thing, isn't it? She belonged to 5 carpools and once blew up 234 balloons by herself for the school fete. Everyone said Sharon was a terrific mother. Her husband said it. Sharon washed the car when it rained. She put the children on their backs at night to make sure they didn't sleep on their faces. Everyone said Sharon was a terrific mother. Her best friend said it. She built a bed out of scraps left over from the patio. She crocheted a Santa Claus to cover the extra roll of toilet paper at Christmas time. She washed the fruit before her children ate it. She learned to play the harpsichord. And when the group and the family ate out, she always figured out who owed what. Everyone said Sharon was a terrific mother. Her minister said it. Sharon found time to read all the dirty books and campaign against them. I don't know where that's coming from, sorry. She played guitar at evening services. She corresponded with a poor family in Guatemala in Spanish. Everyone said Sharon was a terrific mother. Sharon was one of those mothers blessed with the knack of being organized. She planned a theme party for the dog's birthday, and her knots came out just right on the shoelaces when they'd been broken. She put a basketball hoop over the clothes basket as an incentive for good habits. She started seedlings in a toilet roll, and she insulated the house with empty egg boxes, which everyone else had thrown away. Everyone said Sharon was a super mother. Sharon was a super mum. Her gynecologist said it. Her butcher said it. Her tennis partner said it. Her children never said it. They spent time with Grandma, who was always home, and who ate biscuits straight out of the packet, and who played silly games with them. Actually, from a book called Motherhood, the Second Oldest Profession. It shows up, doesn't it, really, how... And it wasn't you, Sharon, okay? It shows up, doesn't it, how sometimes we strive to be that perfect parent, and yet actually the kids need a bit more room than that. Which begs the question then of how do we discipline our children? It's just this week there were debates on the radio about how to discipline your child. The focus was smacking and all the new legislation that they're trying to bring in or they have brought in, or they haven't brought in some cases. But the wider context came through really, and it showed the extremes in the studio of the laissez-faire parent. Let Johnny find his own way in life. He has to learn and grow and mature in his own way. And, of course, the over-strict parent who thinks that Mary should not be seen and not heard. So what's the answer? Well, the Bible, I think, again, is quite clear that correction and discipline are good for your children. And I'm going to read three short passages of Scripture. The first one, Hebrews chapter 12 and verses 5 to 11, talks about discipline as we see how a heavenly father disciplines his children, but it passes on to children. Have you forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons? My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Proverbs 23, verses 13 to 14. Again, famous, probably. Do not withhold discipline from a child. If you punish him with the rod, he will not die. Punish him with the rod and save his soul from death. And a cracking verse I found in Deuteronomy chapter 21 verse 18, which just sums up this issue of discipline for me. Deuteronomy 21 verse 18. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother and will not listen to them when they discipline him, his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders at the gate of the town. And they shall say to the elders, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. Then all the men of his town shall stone him to death. You must purge the evil from among you, or all Israel will hear of this and be afraid. I missed a couple of words out there, which probably bring a bit of context to it. The fact that this son was profligate and a drunkard. Just skip that, because it didn't have quite the same effect, did it? Ephesians 6, verses 1 and 4 has two things, doesn't it? Children, obey your parents. And fathers, do not exasperate your kids. Discipline is the setting of boundaries and the establishing of values. And then training your kids within those boundaries and according to those values. Discipline isn't punishment, but punishment sometimes is necessary if your child is to be trained in the right way. And I have to say, if your child has never needed punishment, then you're either an excellent parent or a very lucky one. I'm grateful to this book here, Aren't They Lovely When They're Asleep, by a lady called Anne Benton, who just spells out four things about rules for discipline for children. Firstly, the need to establish rules. Now, these are boundaries within which your child has freedom to grow and learn and experiment, but outside of which it might be dangerous or it might not be safe to go. So you can imagine the whole playing with fire thing, or playing with traffic, or that kind of thing is obviously there's a boundary there. You don't want your children to cross, because you want your children to be safe and not to enter into danger. Now that's an easy example, isn't it? But the hard part is setting those boundaries. Where do we set those boundaries? Whose boundaries do we set? And I'm afraid you're not going to get any help from me there, because having had four children, I think it's fair to say that each child needs different boundaries in some ways, and yet the same boundaries in some ways. I was trying to explain what I mean. Don't play with fire, don't play with the traffic is an easy one, isn't it, every child should need. But it soon becomes grey, doesn't it? You know, don't eat soil. Don't eat worms. Is that why? You know, is that why is that? Is it unsafe to eat worms? I used to do it. All right. Look at me. Do you know who? Oh, look at me. Yeah. It's suddenly from an obvious one like don't play with the traffic, you get something that some parents might say, and you think, well, why? Don't eat soil. Yeah, this whole hygiene thing is it good for us? And should we eat a bit of soil from time to time to help us, you know, build up our immune system, that kind of thing? Perhaps not the best example, but nevertheless, you understand that there are different levels of boundaries here according to different sort of areas of life. And the best help perhaps I can offer are biblical, but the two great commandments about loving God and loving others as yourself, the golden rule, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The whole one anotherness thing are great values, aren't they? Respect one another, care for one another, love one another, share one another's burdens. That whole respect for other people, I think, are values that we should instill into our children, and boundaries and values that we should instill into our children. But they are the basics within which the nitty-gritty is worked out. You have to establish rules, and what this lady here says is that you have to be realistic within that. So not specific help, I realise that, but nevertheless, establish rules. Secondly, you have to explain those rules. Because if your child doesn't know the rules, and the only time he gets to know those rules is when you're telling him off because he's broken one of those rules, then you're not being fair to your child. You need to be clear. You need to explain why these rules are there. You need to involve your child and ask your child why he thinks you're setting these rules, so that you can involve him in the whole process of making moral judgments and values in the future. So you need to explain those rules as well. You need to enact the rules. It's true, isn't it, that much of children's behaviour is caught and not taught. And so we need to model the behaviour and the values and the standards and the boundaries that we want from our children. It's so scary when your kids say things that they've heard you say and you realise just how wrong, actually, it is to say that. It happens to me all the time. So we need to enact those rules as well. And we need to enforce the rules. And the words she has here are firm, consistent and self-controlled. Your rules should be the same yesterday, today and forever. Grandparents should have the same rules as the parents. This is what she's saying. I'm thinking, yeah. But you know, it's so difficult when you've got children at different ages. It's really hard. Because a child, when he's older, is able to do things that a younger child can't do. But the younger child can't understand that he can't do them. You know, carrying a cup of tea in, or making the tea for you. You know, your 12-year-old, your 8-year-old probably can do that, can they? No. But the 6-year-old, it's dangerous for them, isn't it? But they don't understand why they can't do that, why there are those kind of boundaries. So you need to be careful as well, I think, which just makes it all a bit of a minefield, and I realise I'm not helping at all here. For my money, smacking's okay, but we need to be self-controlled in it, and none of us would want to smack our children. But from time to time, when the rules are broken and consistently broken, the child needs to learn you know, why and what happens if they do break these rules. And the advantage of smacking, and again this lady endorses this in this book, is that it's soon over and you can explain and cuddle after the smack. She talks about her own child who was smacked once when they were very young, and after that always ran away from being smacked. But when it had done something wrong, it used to say, I'll smack myself, mummy, I'll smack myself, mummy, because it didn't really want to be smacked by its mummy. So establish rules, explain rules, enact rules, and enforce rules. Probably time has passed us by, hasn't it, really? I don't want to go much further than that, except to say that what a privilege it is, actually, to have children, to train your children, to bring your children up, and to watch them grow into responsible adults as well. But what a responsibility.